You're listening to the Screaming Pods Network.
Welcome to another episode of Just the Discs. My name is Brian Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. I have the wonderful and talented Miss Stephanie Crawford joining me again this week. Hello, Stephanie.
Hello. Thank you for that introduction.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for coming back. I know our last episode was well received. For those that may or may not have heard the Rappin' Hell Knight episode, I didn't hear a single person that didn't enjoy it. So if you haven't heard it, go and have a listen to it.
Do you ever get negative feedback, though? You're so beloved.
I don't know. I mean, I guess maybe people just keep it to themselves if they have the negative feedback. So I guess
that
I don't
is
even
true.
Know.
People love keeping their negative opinions themselves on the internet. Right.
That's true. There's almost no negativity at all. So there must be a lot of people keeping it to themselves.
Come on, gentle lambs. Let them know.
So we are attempting to at least rival the pairing that we did for the last episode, and we actually talked about this pairing on that episode, and so we're going to do two movies that are also very different as Rappin' and Hell Knight were, and we're going to talk about Rockula and Leatherface, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3. So what were your... So Rockula, you know what's funny is I noticed that both of these films are from 1990, and that was totally coincidental. So that's a neat serendipity thing.
Yeah, they always say like the first few years of a decade are pretty much the last decade.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. I would say Rockula does feel like an 80s film. Leatherface feels pretty early 90s to me, though. I wouldn't guess they were the same year.
No, I wouldn't either. In fact, when we get to Leatherface, I'll talk about how it doesn't feel even 90s to me personally. It actually feels like ahead of its time in a lot of ways. But let's talk about something that's not ahead of its time, and that's Rockula from 1990.
He's shy. Misunderstood.
What do you do?
I'm a vampire.
Have you ever seen one of these before?
18th century, right?
And he hasn't scored in 400 years.
Man, that dude so got the blues.
He just met the perfect girl. And lost her for the 14th lifetime in a row.
Just forget the fact that we are the oldest living virgins walking the planet.
But all that is about to change. Because if the devil sold his soul, he still couldn't rock and roll like Rockula.
Rockula down, the vote is down. My name is Rockula, from the Claymore fan right now.
So what were your impressions of this film? If you had to try and sum up this movie to someone who has not seen it, how would you go about doing that?
Okay, wow. Okay. Well, you have your classic tale of a virginal, seemingly young man, and he loves his mom, but she's a little quirky. She doesn't quite get it. And so he's just kind of making his way, trying to figure himself out. He just happens to be a vampire who's kind of stuck in this cyclical historical thing with like a romantic curse kind of, and wackiness ensues.
There you go. Yeah, so first thing in my notes, inspiration for Sing Street, clearly, because because the basic...
All they did was remove fangs and add accents and you got Sing Street.
Totally. It's really the same movie, ultimately. And I can't believe there wasn't more calling out of this fact when that movie was being praised, last year or whenever. It's crazy. Because you do have a movie where basically a boy meets a girl and decides to start up a band in order to gain her favor. So clearly the same thing, really.
Yeah, though this one is much better than Sing Street because it has a band montage. Will we be a mariachi band? Will we be a barbershop quartet? Let's just try it all out.
Oh my gosh, that is one of the things I love about this movie is that there's that band montage, which I mean, we've all seen the you know, trying on clothes montage, which this kind of is that, but it's also, like you said, just trying out different kinds of band things. So that is actually one of my favorite montages in a quasi-80s movie that I've seen. But the fact that then he also performs a couple different songs in a couple different musical styles throughout the film is also very charming. I was going to say that the word I think of when I think of Rockula is charming, because I think it's a really sweet movie.
Absolutely. And everyone is so game. There's you can tell everyone had fun and was like buying into everything. Like, you can almost feel Susan Tyrell kind of laughing behind the scenes as she like put on these different outfits.
That's the other part that's great about that montage, is that Susan Tyrell is in that montage. That's fucking great. Yes. I mean, we should run down the rest of the cast in this movie. Obviously, Dean Cameron is the headliner, and I adore him, so, you know, I'm in anyway. But then his mom is played by Tony Basil. The sort of nemesis of the movie is played by Thomas Dolby. and Bo Diddley, I think, doesn't he participate in the montage a little bit too?
Mm-hmm.
Oh man, that's funny. He puts on some crazy shorts at one point. And anyway, yeah, this movie just has like cult written all over it because of not only the musical numbers, but also like Dean Cameron plays like a dual role where he's his own reflection, and so he talks to himself literally.
Yeah, a mere Dean Cameron is not a virgin. I'll just say that.
Yes, that was one of the things I noticed too about this movie, is I was like, well, this is a lot like a counterpart film to Teen Witch, in that it has musical numbers in it that are quite outlandish, and it has this like streak of perversion in it that feels almost out of place, but ultimately I guess kind of fits because we're talking about teenagers in quotes in both movies. But I do feel like Rockula deserves more of a cult than it has. It should have a cult that rivals the cult of Teen Witch, in my opinion. And I think due to lack of availability for the most part, and I don't know how much of an actual release it even got based on what the special features were saying. Did you get a sense it really got any kind of release at the time, or?
From what I can tell, no, it kind of landed with like a soft thud. No, I agree, especially like throughout the years, even though they were kind of cult films, I would hear about like Transylvania 65,000, which isn't like too far away from the tone of this.
I've heard stories. Stories about us? No. I mean, Frankenstein.
Who?
Frankenstein. You know Frankenstein, don't you? Frankenstein. Yes, the monster.
Ah, did Frankenstein. Jutta!
No.
Yes, Danko?
Have you seen Frankenstein lately?
Frankenstein? I don't think so. Oh, Mayor?
No, don't bother the mayor. Please don't.
This man is asking about the Frankenstein.
But seriously, like, I was just looking around Amazon Prime and I saw Rockula and I saw the like truncated cast list and I read the synopsis. I was like, excuse me, I'm kind of angry I haven't heard of Rockula. And I remember tweeting about it, and one of my friends, Mike31 on Twitter, or the Mike31, was like, no, Rockula's the greatest movie. Watch it right now.
Yeah, it is amazing. I know there's a couple other people I talked to on Twitter that are huge Rockula fans. And I was definitely a fan, but rewatching it on this Blu-ray cemented my absolute undying dedication to this film. It's just so delightful.
When was the first time you saw it?
I feel like I might have seen it on VHS in the late 90s, because one of my coworkers was a big Dean Cameron fan. I mean, I was too, but he was a bigger Dean Cameron fan. And he found it at some point. He was just like, you know, he would find weird movies like Rock and Rule and He was a big fan of like The Brave Little Toaster before anybody I knew was talking about that movie. And he just had some other odd favorites. And I feel like Rockula was one of the ones that he found. Like, we had a big clamshell VHS of it at the video store. And I think it ended up not renting and he bought it. So we would just watch his copy at his place. But yeah, so I saw it back then, but I don't know. It didn't make the impression that it did this time for some reason. I don't know why, but yeah, it just really charmed me. It just really hooked me. It's one of those where I'm like, I got to show this to Raven like really soon. Although there's some like perverse stuff in it, I still think she'd get a kick out of it. Although I was trying to play, her some of the songs in the car on the way home. I picked her up from an event at my wife's school tonight, and I tried to play her the rap song, and she was like asking for something else pretty soon after that.
Kick it!
Whoa.
How's that?
Whoa, that's some kick.
Thank you.
Jeez, what a weird guy.
There was this girl named Mina. She wanted Melina. She was singing back for Ike and Tina. I liked her bangs. She liked my fangs. So we decided to do the crazy Rapula thing. Now her father didn't like it, so he called me a pig. I said, Dr. Van Helsing, here's something you'll dig. We can sing Kumbaya around the campfire.
Are you the DJ?
No, I'm the vampire. I said I'm the vampire.
Out of context, I'm not sure how that would play.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Of course.
So throughout, like, endlessly talking about Rockula, I've noticed that men of a certain age love Dean Cameron. Like, love him. I'm just wondering. He's great, don't get me wrong, but I'm just kind of wondering why he seems like universally beloved with so many men.
I think it has a lot to do with summer school. I think it stems from that.
Is this some kind of sick, twisted joke?
Nope. Combining Denise's driving lesson with your ride to the beach. Come on, get in.
We took driver training with Denise. Call us a cab.
Get your grizzly butts in the car.
And let me drive. I'm going for my license next week.
Chainsaw. You've been drinking.
No, it's cough medicine. Check out this phlegm.
Save the phlegm. You're not driving anywhere.
I'll tell you something, and this is fact. You know why so many drunk drivers get in wrecks? Because they don't learn to drive drunk.
Fact. Alcohol kills brain cells. You lose one more, you're a talking monkey. Come on, get in. Come on! Okay, Denise, start her up. Signal left. Pull on up.
Can I call my folks and say I won't be home? Ever.
The Chainsaw and Dave characters are just so... yeah, they're just great. I mean, they're really the heart of that movie for me, and I love that movie. You know, and the other thing was that Summer School was like one of our family movies, like, if you will, like a movie that we had on tape, either off TV or something, so that we would watch it all the time. It was in rotation with, I'm trying to think, what were some of the other, like On Golden Pond was a big one, which is nothing like Summer School. And Pee-wee's Big Adventure was one. And I feel like there was a couple more that I'm blanking on. Well, there was definitely a couple more, but there was a couple more that were like in the, you know, group with Summer School, and I cannot remember what they were, but Summer School was just a big deal to us. And so I would just quote that movie all the time. You know, I would do Tension Breakers randomly.
Tension Breaker had to be done.
And Frighten People, you know, that kind of stuff. So I think I saw that. And then I'm trying to remember, I was a really big fan of Kicking and Screaming in the 90s, and he has a small role in that.
When I make my movie, they're gonna have a hell of a time finding a category for it. Did I tell you about my movie?
Yes.
Well, it's changed a little bit. Now it's about this guy who lives with his mother, right? And they sort of fall in love. It's real shocking, you know, like Lolita.
There were blood relations in Lolita.
Well, see, I'm doing something different then, and I'm playing with gender roles. They probably put it in offbeat.
They're way offbeat.
See, you're shocked. All right, have this back by Tuesday night. You've got a delinquent missing pizza. Yeah, whatever. See? See, you're shocked. They'd have to invent a section for my movie. That'll be cool, huh? When I make my movie and it comes out on video, you and I can see who rents it. We could probably sit here and watch it on the TV.
He would just crop up in these movies, these other cult movies like that, and he crops up in Men at Work.
Who is it?
Pedro's Pizza and Pancakes.
Okay.
Large pepperoni, extra cheese.
Yes, indeed. That's us. How much?
$8.
How much?
$8.
Okay. One.
What's going on here?
Mind your own business, son.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
You've seen too much.
Which is another movie that my buddy who loved Rockula loved Men at Work, and I loved Men at Work. I still do. So he would just show up in these little other cult movies, and he sort of like became part of the fabric of this universe of cult movies that almost felt like they could, like, it feels like almost like Summer School and Men at Work, maybe not Rockula, but some of the other Dean Camp Kicking and Screaming could like be the same universe somehow. So I don't know. There's something about that continuity that made me remember him for some reason.
All right. Thanks for clearing that up for me.
So do you find that not as many women like Dean Cameron? Is that a thing?
I haven't done an extensive survey on this, but just from like empirical conversation evidence, dudes will bring them up. Women, yeah. I've talked to, it hasn't.
No, it's true. I guess that's right. I mean, I definitely know some women that like Summer School, but they don't always refer to him specifically by name. So, yeah, I mean, I guess he's a dude.
Yeah, I always
actor.
Call them the Fangoria boys. Yes. Because I love Summer School. Yeah. And Shawnee Smith is in it.
Yeah.
That's who I get excited about.
Yeah, she's great. I mean, I love her. That was the weirdest thing to finally see. I don't think I recognized her and Saw at first. And then I was like, oh, my God. From Summer School. Oh, my God. And then, obviously, The Blob. She's great in The Blob. But...
Right, but
I connect
yeah,
everything
you
to
see
school.
Her in like The Stand and The Blob, and she looks so young and Saw. You're like, that's not the same person. The age doesn't match up.
Yeah, it just doesn't feel right. And I think that was the thing. I was just like, did I go into a time warp? How does she look? Anyway, I love her. She's great. I wish she was in Rockula too, but we have to settle for what's her name? Tawny Ferrer?
Some disrespect going on here.
I don't know how to say her name. I was going to re-listen to the commentary to get the pronunciation of her name.
Yeah, she is on the commentary. And yes. She's delightful.
Yes, she was. She
and
was
you
quite
said
good.
Settle.
I'm sorry. No, she is very good. In fact, there's something about certain 80s and 90s movies where you would have a really adorable actress who did a great job, and I don't mean to downplay the fact that she plays a great romantic interest for the Rockula character, and you would have this occasionally. You'd have like a woman that would show up in a movie, and then you wouldn't see her much in too many other movies, and you'd associate her with a single movie and always go like, why didn't I see her in more stuff? Because she's really good, and she can sing, which she makes a point of talking about on the commentary.
Right.
And yeah, and she has a song that she sings in the movie. So, like, there's just a lot of reasons why I feel like she should. I know she did other movies, but not too many that I saw. I only know her from this. So I kind of, I'm always bummed when that happens. You know, it's not a phenomenon, you know, solely dedicated to the 80s. But I, for some reason, noticed it more then.
Well, I guess you get the time period where you can really see where their career would be throughout time, and then you don't really see very much.
Yeah, I think that's it. So what's your favorite song in the Rockula soundtrack?
Tony Basil raps in it.
Yes.
That's my favorite.
That's pretty great.
Again, and all I wanna do is jam with my friends, and jamming is what I'll do, and I'll jam the house, I'll jam it down on you.
My mom's kind of strange. If you hadn't noticed.
This whole night has been kind of strange.
Yeah, she's...
Plus, it's like the most adorable scene with like her muscle man boyfriend, like cheerfully manning the record player. And then, of course, he stumbles on it and it says old school, whoop, 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 because we can't escape rap here. When you and I talk, we can't escape it.
This is a thematic that has to continue, clearly. Yeah, that's super funny. I forgot that he bumped into the record player. That's hilarious. Yeah, she's great. She's just like one of those like one-of-a-kind presences, you know, like as a pop star and an actor. Like, I just can't think of too many people that have the feeling that she has when she appears on screen. You're just like, oh my God, she's a perfect vampire mom, you know?
She is, and she is gorgeous in this.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say.
Yeah, she is. It's one of those where you're like, she looks a little young to be his mom, but like then again, they're vampires, so who knows?
Vampires.
Yeah. So it actually kind of works. What do you think of Dean Cameron in this?
I'm not a bad vampire. I am a bad vampire. I'm not very good at it. I don't bite people, but I am a vampire.
Ralph, this is a very common thing.
It is?
Yes, sure it is. People begin to believe their stage personas all the time.
No. I don't think I'm a vampire. I really am a vampire.
Prove it.
Look, Fang, see?
Well, it's probably something that just runs in the family, Ralph. Besides, I knew a girl in the eighth grade. She had bigger teeth than that. She wasn't a vampire, Ralph. You really should have those filed down, though.
Okay, all that stuff my mom was talking about back at the house, it's all true. Mona, you are 422 years old. This is your 19th lifetime. You always die on Halloween night of your 22nd year.
Ralph!
Mona, we were lovers 400 years ago, and every 22 years since then, and it always ends the same way.
And how is that?
You were killed by a pirate with a peg leg wielding a gigantic ham bone.
And then I'm reborn.
Over and over.
I think maybe you just need some therapy, Ralph.
I love him.
Yeah.
I think he sometimes the kind of like bumbling virginal character can be a little much. They can be kind of annoying in films, especially comedy centric films. But he's not. He's a good dude. He loves his mom. he really commits to his band, no matter what genre they're covering. he really lets loose with his mirror image version. Like pretty much everyone else in the cast, like he goes in 100%.
Yeah, no, he definitely does. I love hearing on the special features too how they were talking about like, the mirror stuff. They had like mirrored sets, and he would have to like if they would the stand-in would have walk to another mirror, and Dean Cameron would have to run around the set and stuff. But it works. Like he's just got a great manic energy throughout, but definitely as the mirror character, it really works, and he's just like a totally different dude in that way. And I guess I've always liked double and triple roles in a movie because I think it seems kind of silly when you watch it, but I just think it's neat to watch an actor do that, you know, like act with themselves, more or less. It's I don't know. I think it's fun.
It was a lot of fun. Yeah.
So in terms of special features, we talked about the commentary with the director, Luca Bercovici, actress Tawny Rare, and composer Hilary Bercovici. So you listened to this whole track. I didn't listen to the whole thing. Did you enjoy it?
I did. Did you get to the part about the tombstone?
I don't think I did. What? Tell me about it.
Oh, that was the juicy part. That was exciting.
What do you remember?
I'm just kind of immediately questioning myself on thinking this is exciting. Okay. But the tombstone behind them says band on it.
Okay.
And the director also directed Ghoulies, which was an Empire picture show.
I see where this is going.
And he said, I put band on there as kind of a nod to Charlie Band. And I think that's all I'll say about it. And he moved on.
Wow. Clearly a great working experience.
This is what I listen to commentaries for. Just give me a little bit of gossip.
That's good. I like that. Well, it does sound like he had some troublesome productions, and I think he said the same thing was true of Ghoulies, where basically he had what was a dramatic story, dramatic script, and then the producers were like, no, make it a comedy. And I think that happened with Ghoulies as well. I think he mentions that. Maybe I'm wrong about that part. But it definitely happened with Rockula, where it was a dramatic story, and then they asked him to make it a comedy at the 11th hour or something.
I think maybe titles are the problem. You got Ghoulies, you got Rockula. I'm not seeing the drama here.
Yeah, no,
it's true.
The Grapes
of Wrath, now that's a dramatic title.
I agree. Yeah, Ghoulies doesn't... I wonder if they changed the titles. No, but he said he had Rockula to start. So, yeah, how can you... that wasn't well thought out. But anyway, I just think there's a lot of craftsmanship on display, a lot of care put into this movie, from the musical numbers to the stuff with the, you know, dual acting of Dean Cameron and the wacky music video that they film in the middle of it, which has one of my favorite like lip syncing gags, where like Dean Cameron gets hit by a car and he's on the windshield of the car singing the song. That is priceless. But anyway, you know, it's just one of those things where you kind of feel bad for, like, the people involved are clearly appreciative of the cult the film has developed, but you're kind of like, you get a sense, especially from the Dean Cameron interview, that he was like, this is my big break, you know, this is going to be the one that puts me, you know, like, launches my career, and it just fizzled completely. So there's like this bittersweet feeling with some of the people involved, and you kind of feel bad. You're just like, oh, it's too bad. You made a movie that's really a lot of fun, and you know, it wasn't ever really destined for, you know, super mainstream commercial success, even if it had gotten a proper release, but it certainly deserved more love than it got, and that's just a shame, you know.
Rockula, well, you know, here's the thing. I get some shit from people about the movies I did. And you know, David Lee Roth said this great thing. He said, I don't get all the women I want. I get all the women who want me. And that was my deal with movies. Rockula fulfilled something that I'd been wanting to do since I was a child, which was carry a movie.
Yeah.
Right? It was my first time. And I also, it was an offer. It's the first offer I'd ever gotten. And I got to sing and play guitar. And it's like, you know, every actor is a frustrated rock star. And so was I. And it was just it was a fun time. And it was Canon Films did these crazy movies. Mm-hmm. These crazy Israeli mafia guys who just threw money around and did movies. Like Kathy Ireland did a movie called Alien from L.A., which was on the same roster as Rockula. And if there's a great Mystery Science Theater of Alien from L.A. where they're just, she's talking and someone just goes, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up. Brutal. So that was what was going on that year. It was like 89 or something. And I had come, after summer school, there was this strike and all the wind had been knocked out of my career. And I was
trying to work, and so I got Rockula, and it was a great time.
Yeah, I would say not that it didn't deserve to be successful, but it is such kind of, it's an odd duck of a film, but definitely deserves to be one of those movies where they could show up to conventions and everyone who cares enough to pay to go to like a genre convention would be like, oh my God, the cast of Rockula. Yeah. Are you kidding me? Can you sign this poster? It definitely deserves that.
Damn, I want a Rockula poster. That's one I don't have. I need that for my office now that I'm thinking about it.
A vinyl soundtrack.
Oh yeah. Mondo, come on. Clearly, that should be your next thing. Before I forget, the other two special features on this disc are a new interview with Luca Bercovici and then the Dean Cameron interview, all of which I thought were pretty good. Did you dig the special features overall? The commentary I know you liked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were nice interviews, you know. Nothing too notable, but they both went pretty in-depth, and Dean Cameron looks great.
Yeah, he does.
If anyone was wondering, nice salt and pepper beard. It's good stuff.
Yeah, he's aged well. I think I mentioned on the other show that you should follow him on Instagram for when he does his live feeds of him playing guitar at various nightclubs. So definitely do that.
Does he ever dress like a Elvis vampire?
He does not, sadly, that I've seen. He seems like he looks like he does in that interview, basically. Just rocking out, you know? I just love that he's a dad, too. That's kind of funny and neat to me that Rockula is a dad. I don't know why. Just find that amusing. All right, well, let's move on to Leatherface, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3.
I like Texas.
So we talked about this the last one, and you're a big fan of this movie, correct?
Yes and no.
Whoa, what does that mean?
Okay, yes and smaller yes.
Okay, explain.
I would say that when it comes to Leatherface, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3, I am a little bit more enchanted about the behind-the-scenes stories about how it came to screen rather than what ended up on the screen. As a movie itself, I do enjoy it. However, if I didn't read so much about how it got made, I probably wouldn't enjoy it quite as much as I do.
Yeah, I'd be curious to know more about it. I mean, I listened to the entire commentary, and I watched the deleted scenes featurette thing and the, you know, half an hour long making of documentary, and it is fascinating stuff, you know. It's one of those stories that kind of makes you go, man, being a director kind of sucks. You know, I mean, especially if you're like a good director and you came from like an independent background like Jeff Burr does, and you got a couple things done right, you know, like what was the anthology movie Offerings?
From a whisper to a Scream.
Yeah, that's
also
the one.
Has Susan Tyrell in it.
Oh, nice.
See, we always find a connection.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's a great anthology. One of the better horror anthologies out there, you know. And then he did Stepfather 2, which between those two movies, I think that's what he said got him the gig for Leatherface. And I remember liking Stepfather 2, but it just sounds like he was behind the eight ball from the word go with this particular movie. It's kind of sad, you know?
We were prepping it without a director. We had a designer, a cameraman, and we were all kind of working blindly. The studio was desperately trying to find the right person to direct this show.
I think who they really wanted to direct the movie, even then, which showed good taste on their part, was Peter Jackson.
I'd put him up for Nightmare on Elm Street, for Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and ultimately took all these years to affiliate on Lord of the Rings. But it ultimately came down to a short list of two or three filmmakers, of which Jeff was one.
I really was like the first guy that they kind of said, I guess we can tolerate him, that would accept the job. I'm really an independent filmmaker at heart and in spirit. I'd gone to film school at USC, made a short film there that won a lot of awards. My first movie was just made totally independently. It's called The Offspring. and it starred Vincent Price, kind of a horror anthology in the vein of Tales from the Crypt. And then we made Stepfather 2, and that was successful. It was supposed to be a made-for-video thing that Miramax ended up picking up, and it went theatrical.
Having just done the Stepfather sequel, they said, well, if you could do that, you could do this.
I got a phone call in July saying, can you come in to meet? We're very, very interested in you directing the movie. We're totally out of the blue. I got hired like right around July 4th weekend. We started shooting like July 19th.
And then it was just run and gun.
The frustrating thing doing a sequel like that is the expectation and the idea that the film can't function just as a film. It's got to function as a kickoff to more films.
Yeah, no, it's swimming upstream the entire way. And when I was bothering him years ago, asking him questions, he said, it's funny, it's by far the movie he's best known for and he worked the least amount of time on.
Wow, that's
and interesting. That has to be strange.
Worked the least amount of time. Yeah, I guess he said it was like a 6-week shoot. And wow, that's funny.
Yeah, he was fired and then rehired. And
yeah, I mean, well, and the other thing it was interesting for me to watch the movie. Having not seen it, I thought I had seen it. I legitimately did, but in watching it, I'm like, I don't remember this. I don't remember Ken Foray, you know. I definitely loved him in this, and he's somebody that like I would have remembered because I've loved Dawn of the Dead since I was in high school, and so if I see him in a movie now, I'm always like, oh, there he is.
Ken Foray, I wanted to put in the movie because I was a big fan of Dawn of the Dead.
How many?
We don't know. 2, maybe more.
He had a nice genre identification, and also he was just physically perfect for it.
Sounds like he's just a few quarts shy of a full tank, you know what I mean?
And I think he's, like, really good in this. Like, I really, like, I like him almost more in this than I do in Dawn of the Dead, as blasphemous as that might sound. It just feels like he's gotten to be a better actor in the years since Dawn came out, and so he plays it really well. But yeah, I just hadn't seen it, and it's a really interesting, intense, like, from the trailer, which is a really fun teaser where this, you know, chainsaw comes out of the water, like, you know, the lady in the lake kind of thing, and so I thought it might be like Texas Chainsaw 2, which I like but I don't love.
I love.
I understand. I totally get
love.
Why people.
You're in the majority, though.
I don't. Am I? I thought a lot of people really like.
People are coming around on it, but man, like.
And I am too.
When it came out, obviously, and even like throughout the 90s and early 2000s, I had a hell of a time finding other people who liked it.
Yeah.
Thankfully, it's grown on people, I think.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a tough tonal thing that I think he does pull it off, but I think it's hard. I don't know, for some reason my entry point in that film is it's hard for me to find one, you know, like, so like I can't fully, but each time I watch it I like it more, and that cast is remarkable, so there's a lot of great stuff happening there, but I guess there's a little too much campy in it for me, and I like the sort of intense, although it's funny, I like the intensity of this movie because it's not campy, I don't think, at all. It's really playing it scary. It's playing it real. But then it gets to a certain point and it becomes almost like torture porn-ish, or what would become that. It is in terms of a certain kind of feeling that I get from a certain kind of horror movie. And that starts to pull me out of movies. So it's like I want the intensity, but I guess I don't want it to go quite so far, but ultimately where else is it going to go with this kind of a story, you know? So I don't know, but it was great to watch it. I'm glad you brought it up on the last episode, because I was definitely going to check it out, but I was like, oh, we got to do a show on this because I clearly need to watch this movie.
Yeah, I think one of its weaknesses might be a little bit of a mean, ugly tone that doesn't seem quite as naturalistic as it does in the original. And I think that might be fall a little bit on part 2. I think they were overcorrecting a little bit. I know David J. Scow said he didn't dislike the second one, but he knew that's not what the studio wanted, and he didn't really want to follow that tone, and Jeff Burr wasn't a fan.
Once they said, what would you do with Leatherface? I went back and I watched the first film closely, and I said, what are some things that I can draw out of this and maybe build a new story out of? And the first notion was to get rid of the remnants of the original family immediately, because I wanted Leatherface to have a kind of adopted nuclear family based on the idea that like sensibilities had kind of attracted each other. You know, they wound up with this little core group of new misfits. Everybody's inclination was to disregard the sequel. However, the sequel contains the line, "The Saw is family," which I appropriated for Chainsaw 3, which wound up all over the posters and all over the chainsaw and, you know, and everything else.
So I almost think, I was a little bit overcorrecting. They're trying to kind of prove that, no, Leatherface in the series, it's gritty. It's, you know, it makes you feel like there's dust in your blood. And and the MPA was like, maybe less dust in the blood. You have to show the blood.
Yeah, it's so sad to me to hear Jeff Burr talk about going back to the, well, again, stacked against him on the studio and production side. You know, they're breathing down his neck while he's producing the movie. He got fired because they were absolutely not going to let him go over budget.
Towards the end of the show, the studio would not extend the amount of shooting time.
Sorry, Tex, we're on a pretty tight schedule today.
I think they thought I'd go over budget or over schedule.
Things come up. And you just have to deal with them.
He comes up to me and goes, "I've got to see your shot list for the next week or you're fired."
I sat down with Jeff, made sure he was aware that this was not a bluff, this was not a game. They would not allow this film to go over budget.
I said, "Well, look, man, this is like week 5 out of 6 weeks. If you can't understand the style I'm shooting in and what I'm doing, I don't know what to tell you."
Well, the studio made their stand and threatened to fire him.
I was fired. Then I got a phone call like Sunday night, and I was rehired. Within those 2 days, they couldn't find a director that they wanted to replace me with.
Jeff rose to the plate, agreed to make the necessary compromises, which is really about time, and came in and finished the movie.
That was terrible. And then the MPAA's already got like an axe to grind against the series, because obviously the first one was a little rough, but then with 2...
Canon had taken the second movie without a rating. MPAA had a real chip on their shoulder anyway about this whole series, and then New Line had always had problems with the MPAA on the Nightmare movies.
Our first submission to the ratings board, it got an X, and now this film had to have an R.
You can't advertise it in a lot of newspapers. Lots of theaters won't play it. You make films for people to see them.
But the MPAA basically says there is no way in hell this movie will ever get a rating.
We went back many, many times to the board where we removed scenes, we adjusted scenes, and we even got to the point where we were pulling out a frame or two at a time.
Why are you doing this?
It's the inevitable process of paring down. I mean, yeah, the script, the film was violent, but we knew that when we sort of greenlit it, so there was no, like, it wasn't like some shocking revelation.
We missed our release date because of that.
I'm not placing the blame on any one person. It was a huge conglomeration of people that collectively fucked the film up. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, they were cutting negatives of the shots while they were submitting it to the MPAA, and they didn't have a protection IP or anything.
Oh,
so everyone was all like, "Oh, when's the like completely uncut, unrated version?" But they were literally cutting the film. So the only way you could get those was the work print VHS.
Oh, wow.
Like unsigned work prints.
So you've seen that?
No.
Oh, okay. See, this is where I was confused about. Obviously, this is the unrated version of the film, and then they have the deleted scenes, sort of. And it seems like there are 2 scenes in particular that were really hammered on. There's one where one of the characters is smacked in the head with a sledgehammer, sort of like Rube Goldberg style. And then there's one where Leatherface is cutting a girl basically in half. But I couldn't understand, and maybe you can help me, did that shot actually work? And were they able to film her like splitting in half? Because it's not in the unrated cut, and it wasn't really in the deleted scenes. I was like, okay, when does she fall in half? And I didn't see it. So what was your take on that?
I really have no idea.
Okay. Yeah, that was where I was like, which cut? And then, you know, there's multiple endings, and I think I kind of like the original ending better than the one they went with. Although she does have a great line that she says.
"Pretty goddamn good, you backwoods motherfucker."
To one of the dudes that's in the ending they went with, which is pretty memorable. So I don't know. So it was one of those things where I was like kind of confused about, as a, you know, movie purist, like, okay, what version is the real I think that this is the most real version that we're going to get, basically. Like you said, outside of a work print VHS or whatever, which, to be fair, I don't think Jeff Burr wants you watching a work print VHS, even if it does have everything. I wouldn't think. I don't know.
Yeah, this is not a good movie for a purist. It was a mess the entire way. Yeah. And the thing was, like, I think when this has, like, all the same extras the DVD had.
Ah.
And I remember everyone was really excited that said unrated because they were kind of expecting what everyone assumed was cut originally. But the thing is like, you could add someone taking a bite out of a sandwich to your film. And as long as you don't submit it for a rating, now it's unrated because you changed something from the original version that was submitted for rating.
Gotcha.
You know, it doesn't mean it's a magically complete version. So, yeah it's a mess. And I don't mean the quality of the film, but if you want to track down like a perfect, complete, the right amount of gore, like filmed perfectly. It's just, I can't imagine it could ever possibly happen with this.
Yeah, that's too bad. I mean, as it is, I mean, and I get why people get obsessive about stuff like that, especially with K and B doing the effects as they did. I mean, obviously those guys do great work, as we know, you know, to the present day, they're still doing great work. So people get really, I think, intense about like wanting to see all of the work, all of what they did, you know. But I don't know, I feel like this, at least for me, this disc, you know, outside of that ending, which is a little wonky, I feel like it does a pretty good job of being relatively intense and showing a decent amount of gore. You know, it all seems relatively tame now anyway, which is another thing that's kind of silly. I think even if they had everything in there, it still might not seem nearly as intense as it did in 1990, just based on everything we have now.
Right, and now you have Greg Nicotero working on The Walking Dead, and every week that stuff surpasses what's in Leatherface.
Right, that's what I mean, yeah. It's just totally, tame isn't quite the right word. It's not that, but because there is an intensity to it and a scariness to it.
Right.
You know, that I love. I really do like that. And I do like that it's filmed, you know, at night, and I guess it's the only one of these that was filmed in California. It was filmed near Magic Mountain.
The bulk of the movie was shot at the Newhall Ranch, which is basically in the shadow of Magic Mountain. There's a few scenes in the movie where, I'm not kidding, you can hear screams from the roller coaster.
We were almost dead between the sets for Tour of Duty and China Beach. And so there's Hueys flying over all the time. It was like making a movie in the middle of the Vietnam War.
So it does have a different feel, even though it can pass as Texas. Once I hear that, then I'm suddenly like, oh yeah, I kind of feel a little bit of the California in it. But they definitely do a good job of passing California as Texas. But another thing they do a great job of is pitch blackness. Like, these are roads that are not lit at all. And, you know, if you break down by the side of the road, you may not have somebody coming to help you. And that sort of isolation is one of my favorite things in horror movies. It's just this, like, you're trapped and you're fucked. There's nothing you can do.
Yeah, they have that feeling down to a silence. And it's a very wet movie, which helps things show up in all the night shots.
That's like, true. I hadn't thought about that, yeah. Yeah, there is a lot of wetness and stickiness and blood. And there's a great, like, and I didn't even get this the first time I watched it, that there's a whole body pit that is apparently just like festering with bodies and grossness. And,
yeah, and I guess that was a big contention with the censors, was the body pit.
So they had to cut around it a little bit so you don't
When you're, you know, in makeup effects, that's where you can just go crazy, you know?
Yeah, like decaying, wet, rotting corpse parts. Yeah, that's true. They could just liquefy to whatever degree you want, or, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, it can get really gross there. But yeah, I remember hearing, I think it was Jeff Burr in the deleted scenes thing, talking about how the main character falls into the body pit, and spoiler, at one point, and then gets away. And then he said something about how she may or may not be like infected or made sick, like deathly ill from the disgustingness in the body pit. And I was like, oh man, that's something I definitely wouldn't have thought of at all, but you're probably right.
I escaped the cannibals. Yeah.
What a horrible way to die from just gross germs. But I, what do you know about Kate Hodge? She's the lead actress in this, and I don't know her from too many other things. And I thought she was great in this.
Yeah, she is great in everything. She was on a short-lived show called She-Wolf of London.
What are you saying? That in my altered state, I destroyed an animal lab, and then I decided to march into the library so I could shove splinters under my fingernails?
Randy, I think perhaps you should return to the States.
No way. I am not taking home some English curse. Damn it. I know what happened last night. It was real. It happened to me. And it means that everything we know is wrong.
Randy, there are no werewolves.
Prove it.
What are you trying to say?
I'm saying that I am not going home. This disease stays until I find a cure. Oh.
And later it was called Love and Curses, which I am a huge fan of.
Wow.
Like the first season of it, it was a little more serious, and then it got really goofy. I can almost say Rockula-esque, maybe, in tone.
Wow.
But... oh, I'm trying to think. I think Mick Garris. Yeah, Mick Garris and Tom McLaughlin created She-Wolf of London.
Oh, that's so cool.
And she starred in the Hidden too, so she has a pedigree.
Look, what exactly are we looking for anyway?
Evil incarnate. Less than a man, but more than an animal. Not dead. Not alive. Sort of like a machine left running.
They use up a host body, throw it out.
It will get ugly.
Starring Raphael Sablarge of Carnosaur and Risky Business, and Kate Hodge of Leatherface, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3, and Rapid Fire. With a special appearance by Michael Nuri.
You lose.
The Hidden 2, directed by Seth Pinsker, is loaded.
It's rock and roll.
With action, suspense, and outstanding special effects.
And I think you need to go down the Kate Hodge lane because I love her.
No, she's
great. She is wonderful, and she's so natural. She's strong in a very believable way. You know,
yeah.
She's not all of a sudden like, oh, nothing affects me, and I can beat this guy who's like four times my size. You know, you can tell she's in pain and incredibly freaked out through the whole thing, but she's a great heroine.
Yeah.
And I think she was filling big shoes because even people who don't like Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 seem to all agree that Stretch Carolyn Williams was an amazing lead.
Yeah, she is good. No, she definitely is good. I don't know if I like Kate more. I don't know. There's something about Kate Hodge in this, though, that really impressed me. I mean, she on top of the acting, she has this look that I just love, and it's like, I was trying to figure it out. It's somewhere between Jessica Harper and like Katherine Hepburn. There's like,
wow.
It was something I was like, what is it about her face? Her face reminds me of Katherine Hepburn, but her eyes and her hair reminded me a little bit of Jessica Harper, and I don't know, it was just, maybe it's my own, you know, cult actress.
I can totally see it now.
Yeah, it's interesting. But the Katherine Hepburn thing worked, too, on the level that she is such a strong character. I mean, Jessica Harper is, too, in a lot of her roles. But, yeah, there's just something about her. I was just like, that was a really neat surprise. Because a lot of times you drop into a movie you haven't seen that's this old with a cast that, for the most part, you don't know outside of Mr. Viggo Mortensen, who is also really good. And you are often kind of like, oh, yeah, I see why I haven't heard of these people. But in this case, I was very impressed. It just all around, there wasn't anybody that I thought was like a weak link as far as the acting. I mean, the little girl is incredible. Like, she's really
so creepy.
Totally creepy. She's like a really slightly evil, like Carol Ann from Poltergeist kind of little girl. You know, and her doll, which is like a little tiny... skeleton?
Husk corpse doll.
Oh my god.
I think she was supposed to be Leatherface's daughter.
Yeah, don't talk back.
You have the question of where the hell did she come from? She was played by Jennifer Banco, who had been in Friday the 13th 7. I think she was only 10. Basically, she could not get into the movie that she's acting in. So you worry that she's going to be scarred for life or, you know, by some of the stuff she saw on the set.
If you don't poke them, then they don't leak.
But yeah, she's just got like a couple lines that she delivers like spot on perfect in the creepiest, most disturbing way. And I was just like, damn. That's, I don't know. I got to give some credit to Jeff Burr. I really feel like, you know, you've got great actors, but he's able to maintain the intensity and the tone despite all of these other problems that he was having. And I just can't imagine what this movie would have been like had he been left to his own devices. That is a little bit of a bummer to think about. But I don't know. I think what's there is, for me, I was like, it's not like I was expecting to not like it, but knowing the sort of difficulties surrounding the production, I was like, okay, am I going to be watching a whole movie or part, you know, a movie that's kind of mm-hmm. incomplete? And it's pretty much all there. I mean, like you say, there you could get more gore from a work print, but I think what's there is actually a pretty solid entry in the series as far as I'm concerned. And it's not my favorite series in the world either. So I don't know. I was pleasantly surprised, I'll say.
Yeah, considering everything that was going on during the filmmaking, after the filmmaking, I think they did an incredible job. It's definitely more of a part two than a part three, I guess, if tonally.
That makes sense. Yeah, no, there's definitely something that doesn't quite line up as a part three when I think about it. Because it kind of is rebooting from the first, a lot of things from the first movie, but not, you know, so... Yeah, well, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that either. But I don't know. I'm glad this Blu-ray's out, and I hope people that have dismissed it give it a look, because I feel like there's a good movie here to be checked out.
Yeah, it's a neat, dirty little horror film. And if you have any interest in what can go absolutely wrong during the filming of a movie, the extras really go into it. It's really satisfying.
Yeah.
No, I'm actually impressed with how candid they were.
Do you remember who was all on the commentary? It was like David Scow, Jeff Burr, one of the actors.
Is a producer guy.
Yeah. I think it was just those four. Oh, and I think Nicotero. Nicotero's on there too. So there's like, yeah, they really do cover all aspects of production. And I don't know.
William Butler.
Yes, that's the guy I was trying to think of.
Who's been killed by so many horror luminaries.
I spent a great deal of my acting career getting killed. I was killed by Jason Voorhees. I was killed by Freddy Krueger and killed by Leatherface. I was killed by all of them except for Michael Myers. I never ran into him.
Gotta fry that sucker if they find him.
I look good crying and running. Or holding a crowbar saying, you know, if I don't come back in 10 minutes, climb out the window and run as fast as you can.
I'll just drive!
And I'm like, wow, that's too bad. You'd think at some point that they could have thrown him into a Halloween movie just to complete the cycle.
They're doing one right now. Just have William Butler get killed really quickly. We got to fill out that bingo card.
Totally.
And I love that Viggo Mortensen was his roommate, and he just picked up the script and said, oh, I'll be in this. And that's how he got in the movie.
That is nuts to me. And that's one of those stories that I love to hear, that kind of like happenstance kind of. And he's so good in it. Like, and he brought some interesting like sexual confusion to the character, or some things that were not there that really, yeah, they really add to it. And he's such a likable guy for me that when he plays villains, I'm always conflicted about it. Not in a bad way, yeah. But in a way where I'm like, damn, he would have totally fucked me over, because I would have, you know, believed his charming approach to begin
with. Absolutely. No, yeah. He's one of like my Hollywood crushes. I would be dead. No, he's the bait. He wears like a frilly pink apron in it. And he's almost the most maternal to the young girl
yep.
in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of like the proto Matthew McConaughey that's in the next one, The Next Generation, except he takes it up like 100 levels. But just like that handsome bait character who at first glance you're like, oh, what happened? Why is he with these gross people? And you find out he's just as fucked up as the rest of them.
Yeah.
And I have to imagine that's like a really juicy kind of role for an actor.
Oh, for sure. And he totally digs into it. Yeah, it's almost like a dual role. It's like you get to play two parts in some ways. I don't want to go too far off on a tangent because I really haven't seen it in a long time, but do you like The Next Generation?
I've got a mind. Just lit your goddamn throat. Give you count to 10, give me a reason why I shouldn't. 9, 8. Don't be late. 7, 6, you better get it right.
You shouldn't kill me.
5, 4.
Yeah, I actually saw it for the first time last year.
Okay.
And I had heard for so long how terrible it was.
I remember hating it, but I honestly, it's been 20 years. I mean, it's been a long time.
God, so. No, I loved it. It was okay. A lot of fun. And it kept up that dirty, gory feeling, but I feel like it kind of cherry picked a little bit from part two with the humor, not so much that it was a parody or was silly, but it has kind of a unique personality. I think it's ripe for rediscovery. If someone wants to do a fancy new Blu-ray, I think it would find a lot of fans that didn't have before.
I need to give it another look because I don't know what it was at the time. I wasn't the biggest. I'm a huge McConaughey fan now, and I've become so over the past, 15 years or so. But maybe I wasn't at that time. I feel like I did. You know what? I feel like the VHS of it came out after his, first. Explosion, like that sort of Time to Kill period when he was in a lot of stuff. I feel like it came out after that, but I could be wrong. I mean, I know the movie came out before that, but at least when I saw it, I must have been in a place where I was maybe a little sick of him. And so to see him go like so far over the top, that's definitely something I do remember, is just being like, whoa, what the fuck is he doing? What is this? This is just ridiculous. And, who knows? Maybe I just wasn't in the right frame of mind.
See, I mean, I'd seen the original that Tobe Hooper did, but it was carny, man. We were shooting in 115 degree weather, myself and Renee Zellweger, about 16 hour days. And it was, I'll say carny. It was a lot of fun. And it was like anything goes. Man. It was anything goes. I actually have been offered the part of a role of a guy who shows up on a motorcycle at the beginning of the movie and at the end of the movie rides off with Renee Zellweger, sort of a Romeo to Juliet role. Yeah. That was never in the film. And when I went in to go, and I was all packed up to drive out to Hollywood because I just graduated college, right? I pull up to that audition to meet with the director with my truck and my U-Haul. I go inside. The director says, Kim Engel says, do you know anybody who'd be right for the Vilma role? This is the role that I played, the killer with the trucker and the record service and stuff. And I said, no. And I thought of two friends that I knew from acting class, and I brought them up to him. And he goes, okay, I'll give him a call. I leave, shake his hand, go out. I remember I opened my truck door, started to step in, and I went, I want to read for that. Shut the door. I went back in, and I said, do you mind if I read for the Vilma part? And he goes, no. We looked around. There's a secretary behind the desk, and he goes, all right. And went in the kitchen, got a spoon, and he goes, scare the shit out of her. And so we threw furniture around, had her pinned up against the wall, acted like the spoon was a knife, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And he goes, now act like your mechanical leg is all messed up and did all this stuff. 5 minutes later, he goes, it's great. You want the part? And I was like, yeah.
It's amazing.
But, yeah, I got to give another look based on how I feel about him now and him having given some of my favorite performances in the past, like, 5-10 years, like Mud and... there's another one. Damn it, I can't remember.
Killer Joe?
I haven't seen Killer Joe yet.
Oh my God.
I know. It's one of Elric's favorites, and it's on my list for Pure Cinema of movies.
Ridiculous in that movie. I mean, in a great way.
That's and I know I'll love it. That's
pure
definitely...
evil. Pure evil.
So anyway, I got to check that out. I got to rewatch that at some point. But so we were talking about, okay, special features, Leatherface. Commentary, and then the Saw's family making of Leatherface, which has pretty much the same group of people that are in the commentary, I think, except they add in the actor who plays Leatherface.
I had a guy in mind that I wanted to bring in, a guy known as Ari Mihailov, who had been an actor in my student film, and he was just perfect for it in terms of just the physicality of it. And he loved horror films.
It's very easy to create the character when you have the mask and the costume and the chainsaw in your hand and your hands are covered with blood. That goes a long, long way. It pretty much takes on an organic life of its own. It doesn't need a lot of introspection.
He seems like a really interesting dude. It was neat to see him talk about, you know, where he's coming from with this character and just his process in general. So that's a great feature, and then We Know What to Do with Them parts, the deleted scenes, is the deleted scenes, but also some documentary, like, interview stuff, so it's a kind of a cool...
Yeah, they guide you through them a little bit.
Which is neat, because I kind of liked, especially with this movie, getting some kind of context and some explanation of what's going... You know, because deleted scenes are cool and interesting, and a lot of times... You watch them and you go, yeah, no, I see why you cut that.
Right.
But in this case, it just adds to the bigger picture of what was going on with this movie. And then on top of that, then they have the alternate ending, which is really interesting to watch. But alternate endings are one of my least favorite things because they always screw with my impression of a movie. Like, when I start thinking about it, now the next time I watch it, I'll be like, but in this other universe, this is what happened. And so I have to... My OCD brain has to be like, no, this is the one.
That, oh.
You know what I mean? I don't know.
So it really sticks in your mind, like almost parallel to the real one?
Kind of. Yeah, it's kind of a weird thing because I know that it exists and so I can't forget about it. It doesn't happen with absolutely every movie, but in this case, especially where I actually kind of like the alternate ending a little more, I get like conflicted. So... But I love that it's included, and like you say, if you want to know about things that can go wrong in a movie and how those involved can persevere and still turn out something interesting, this is the ideal, you know, movie for that.
No Kate Hodge in the extras, though.
That was a bummer. No Kate Hodge. Not surprising that Viggo wasn't in it, although I can't imagine that he's, like, ashamed of his work in it. I'm sure he's just busy. Would be my thought.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if Keanu Reeves can be in the new Bill and Ted documentary, then it's a scheduling conflict, and that's what I'm telling myself.
Yeah, that must be it. Well, anyway, that is that is it for Rockula and Leatherface. Stephanie, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Would you come back if I can find an equally interesting pair of films to discuss?
Yeah, if you can put up with me some more, that would be wonderful.
Excellent. I will start working on our next pairing. It's something that's coming out this year. There's got to be a couple more interesting, a musical and a horror film or something we can put together.
No, Art
No, wait,
House.
We're going to do Art House. Sorry.
More of a rock opula.
That's right. Wait, how many books on Truffaut did you say you own?
Oh, well, okay. I have two on him specifically, and then I have Hitchcock and Truffaut.
Very nice. Because we don't want to pigeonhole you as the schlocky, you know, horror-y.
That's how you see me. That's fine. I sound like a goof. I talk like a goof. Let's just keep on the goof train.
You do not come off like a goof, just so
you know. Full Moon High is coming out soon. That's another one.
Holy shit. Huh? That
Joanne
is,
Nails in that one.
That is
I like
on
her.
Joanne Nails in that. Oh my God. I didn't even realize that. Wow. Switchblade Sisters and
The
and
Visitor.
Full Moon High and The Visitor. She's got an amazing career. God damn, I forgot. Anyway, yeah, no, Full Moon High was legitimately on my notes list of other possible, you know, Stephanie Just the Dis episodes.
Of course it was. So hey, what else is on there?
Just the rest is like all Truffaut and Godard. So
It's like Strawberry Shortcakes, Adventures in the Underworld, something like that.
That's my favorite Truffaut movie. I love that one. That's what I wish they had made that officially part of the Antoine Doignel series, because it really should have been, as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, nerdy jokes. I will try and come up with something worthy of your presence on the show. Whatever it may be, I would love to have you back, and I appreciate you taking the time and staying up late to talk movies with me, ma'am.
Oh, yeah, thank you. I feel valued. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, everybody, have a lovely and Blu-ray filled week, and I will talk to you soon. Bye bye.
King.